This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. So are you ready to take control of your financial future? Meet Portfolio Analyst from Interactive Brokers, the free all-in-one dashboard that lets you consolidate, track, and analyze all your financial accounts in one place. You don't need an IBKR account to use it. Just connect your accounts and see your complete financial picture, your investments, performance, and allocation in one single screen. Plan smarter with IBKR's new tax and retirement planners built around your goals and market assumptions. Get deep portfolio insights with detailed risk assessments and compare performance against more than 300 benchmarks. Plus, manage with confidence thanks to GIPS verified returns. Ready to get started? Sign up for Portfolio Analyst free for everyone at IBKR.com/freepa. Interactive Brokers, the best informed investors, choose IBKR. Member SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Fed cuts and keeps the markets guessing. Silver hits a record, up more than 100% this year. Looking at frameworks and fake transparency. And our guest today is Ed Easterling, founder and president of Crestmont Holdings. All this and much more on episode number 951 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Fed again, and markets were pretty happy about the lack of hawkish tilt that was the expectation going into this. In fact, we looked at all things that were said and tried to round it all up and looked at all the various news outlets and analysts and researchers, and everybody concurs that this was a much more dovish tilt due to the fact that not only are they bringing forward their quantitative easing, which they swear is not quantitative easing. Powell said, no, it's not quantitative easing, but it is quantitative easing when you're buying bonds and using, well, just cash off of a Excel spreadsheet, not anywhere really to be found, to buy those bonds. And that's what's happening. On top of that, there was a discussion about what was going to happen in the future. All this going into play, pretty interesting. So there we have that. Hey, by the way, if you don't know me, I'm Andrew Horowitz, and we are barreling into the end of 2025. And markets were a bit worried about this potential for a really hawkish Fed. But if you really think about it, we also thought there was going to be a bit of hawkishness, meaning that Powell would say that they're worried about inflation or something like that, but he didn't. He talked about inflation, saying that it was there, it was sticky, you know, kind of went around the corners of it, but was much more focused on the fact that they're seeing weakness in the employment situation, even though they don't have the reports that are as current as could be because of the government shutdown. We have a lot of, well, there's a bit of a black hole when it comes to economic indicators right now. But again, markets were not unpleased. In fact, we saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average move dramatically after that through the week and through the end of the week, and that was pretty good overall. Then we hear about this great deal with China, and they're going to be able to get NVIDIA chips, a certain chips set that is older, not as advanced as the latest Blackwell, and that was pretty exciting, but still pretty exciting for a moment. And I bring this up for a very specific purpose, because I think now, towards the end of the year, where we have a lot of things that are going on, and we want to get to the bottom of the discussion to find the truth from the fluff. And this is exactly what's going on right now, the reason that we're not getting too excited about any deals, any frameworks, or maybe even announcements, because they are filled with holes. Despite President Trump's authorization of the sale of the NVIDIA H200 chips to China, we find out that China refuses to accept them and is increasingly putting restrictions on their use. That was a story right out of the Financial Times. No. Well, that's not true. Everybody's saying that's not true and that, you know, everybody's excited about this. The fact is that the administration's idea of transparency, government these days in total, in fact, it's even leaked into the financial markets and corporate America, this idea of transparency. It looks a lot much more like theater than it does substance. Because what's happening is we're seeing this rush, this incredible need to trumpet this good news, but with limited detail on any of it. That's where the word framework comes into play. We've got a framework. What is a framework? There's no detail. It's a theoretical handshake and maybe a wink on what could be, maybe, I don't know, we'll see what happens kind of thing. This is all optics. It's headlines without the meat. That's really what it is. And this vacuum of clarity, it breeds incredible amounts of confusion. And maybe, as we've been talking about for some time, that's exactly the point. Keep the public guessing. Keep me guessing. I'm not exactly sure if I should believe this or that. Let's keep this whole narrative going and very fluid. And we can maintain this control through ambiguity, confusion, lack of anybody's ability to really pin down. It's kind of like trying to, have you ever tried to squeeze a watermelon that is all Vaselined up? And crazy enough, I have. We have, sometimes, you know, when you're young, you have pool games. Get in the pool in the summertime, you grease up a watermelon and you put it one end of the pool and everybody's got to try to grab it and bring it to the other end of the pool, two different teams. What happens? You can't hold on to it for long. It gets loose. That is what we're seeing now. This ambiguity and the ability to bob and weave. And today's Fed move, or this week's actually, was on Wednesday. The meeting was Tuesday, Wednesday. So a couple days back, this modest 0.25% rate cut only amplifies the uncertainty, as I see it, because markets were whipsawed. Traders tried to decide, okay, is this good news? How do I decode what he's saying here? Nothing different, by the way, than any other time. And I got to congratulate Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, for bringing up the subject of having the Fed step back a little, of having the Fed less stage center and maybe back left for a while, because what they're doing is creating more problems than they are solving. And the markets are trying to understand, is this the start of a cutting cycle? Is this just an appeasement because the expectations from various betting, predictive, and Fed funds markets were all about 90% sure that he was going to, or that the Fed was going to cut. Was this a way just to calm the nerves from that? Because these contradictions of what we're seeing are glaring. Think about it for a second. Think about the fact that we have GDP expectations that were increased. The Fed just did it in their meeting. They said that GDP was going to be higher than expected. Inflation's still sticky. And yet the Fed, in their wisdom, decides, well, we are not loose enough. Not only are we going to stop the quantitative tightening program and reissue and pull it up further about 4 months faster than we anticipated, but we're going to reduce rates even further. The Fed's signaling their concern about growth of employment as the number one issue. And yes, we did see also this week, the first time in I think 2 years, a negative print on housing prices on a year-over-year basis. I think it was a year-over-year basis. No, month-over-month basis. Month-over-month. Year-over-year is still up. So yes, there is a problem in the housing market, and that is due to the fact that housing prices are too high. Now, a lot of people want to make this all about the rate. You drop that rate enough, housing prices are going to go back up. It's just a matter of what it is. The affordability problem we have, and we've been looking at this for a long time, of the differential between renting and buying, it's stark. The cost factors of owning a house are dramatic. And it is not the fault of, I don't even think it's the fault necessarily of rates that has made it out of the reach of many people. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, 50% or more of your income has to go to housing to get your bare bones basic starter house these days. That makes no sense. So don't blame the fact that there's a higher rates on this. Don't blame the fact that there's only a 30-year mortgage out there and you want to try to do a 50-year mortgage and really screw folks that are trying to get ahead in life by locking them into something where they're going to pay an extraordinary amount of interest over their lifetimes and never get from underneath the stranglehold that is put upon them by a bank that is giving them a 50-year mortgage. Run the numbers on that, by the way. Go and use your Excel spreadsheet, use your favorite AI, and look at the differential in interest costs between a 30-year mortgage and a 50-year mortgage for, let's say, a $250,000 or $300,000 house at 5%. The numbers are frightening. So here's the question. Is the economy strong? And if it is, why are we cutting rates? If inflation is stubborn, why risk a loosening policy? Right? Fed claims it's all about balance, but the optics right now are suggesting, from the way that I see it here, something is deeper. Now, I don't want to go and start saying things like, well, they know something we don't know, because I don't think they do. They may know at this exact juncture, they may know more because we're in the dark on a lot of things like the CPI, PPI that's a little bit held up, and the unemployment and employment numbers are a little bit held up, and a few other major important economic data points are not there because of the government shutdown. But what I think this is really the deeper issue that I think is a problem is a lack of conviction, or even worse, a deliberate attempt to manipulate sentiment. Because again, investors are left playing this guessing game while policymakers hide behind this vague language and, well, as they call it, data dependency. Data dependency. I mean, that has got to be the most ridiculous thing since we heard, inflation transparency. And by the way, transitionary. Do you know that there was another statement that I read? And I put this on Twitter, by the way. Andrew Horowitz is my handle on Twitter. Make sure to follow me there. Make sure to go there right now and follow Andrew Horowitz. One word. You'll get all the podcast stuff, information, releases very, very quickly. But here's the thing. They're talking about how the tariff cost factors are going to be just a moment in time. They don't want to use the word like they did last time, that is transitory, right? That we have the same issue that we had before. So I don't know what he's trying to do there, because he made that big blunder. He's kind of making it again. So what's with Powell? You know what this feels like to me? This is his Powell's last stand. A calculated move. Which, what he's trying to do is, he's trying to shape his legacy. That's what it looks like and feels like. This is only a short time that he has left to do so. I think he really wants all of us, and maybe even history, to reflect that he was a steady hand, that navigated a storm. He's not the chair who let inflation spiral out of control or growth collapse. But as he's trying to, in his final days, craft this narrative, he may be adding more confusion than clarity. And that's what it is about this economy right now, right? And you got to wonder if what he's doing is for the economy really, or just for the history books. Just so that the written word will be that, you know, here lies Powell, a great leader that navigated us through a crisis and left the economy better than when he got there. That's kind of what I see here. But what's going on with the government, with companies, with the Fed, it's not transparency. Let's get back to that for a second. This is controlled chaos. And if confusion, by the way, is the new policy tool, communication tool, and guidance that companies provide, then, well, mission accomplished. The question is, how long can they keep the markets and the public dancing to this tune before confidence starts to crack? Because we know what happens when these pockets of bullshit reach reality. We see it very plainly. Again, this week is on show and on stage. And we're looking behind the curtain when we saw what happened with Oracle's earnings. Wednesday night after the close, they came out. They had some numbers that looked okay on some fronts, but then the reality was that it's a royal mess over there. Now, we had the stock, in full disclosure, sold it in our last rotation, fortunately, made some nice money on it. But that stock, as we've signaled, by the way, for the last few months, has been the absolute poster child of these wild moves in AI-related stocks and of the underlying question of how this is all going to work in the future. And this is a problem when you start trying to project capital expenditures and income out for many, many years and even a decade when you have no reality or knowledge of what is actually happening from the perspective of how much money is going to be generated from an unknown new technology. And that gets us into the confidence discussion that I think we really need to finish up this segment on, because there's a large differential, a chasm between consumer sentiment and investor sentiment. It's also showing up in the economy as this K economy, where those with money and the haves are doing really well, and those with less money are not. One of those things has to move towards the other eventually. We either get consumer sentiment is going to start picking up to reach investor sentiment, or investor sentiment is going to start souring to reach consumer sentiment. It's hard to keep those separate for long. Think about that. And when we think about sentiment, I think we have to talk about the, oh my gosh, wow, did we see what silver is doing and gold? Silver up about 100% this year. On fire, reaching all-time highs. Gold, just incredible. What is it telling us? What is it telling us? Clearly, there is some commercial and industrial usage of silver. That's a story that goes back years that we've talked about. That's no question about that. But I think the uncertainty and the course of central banks and the central banks buying and the government's buying and some holidays in there, this is really where the punch for this is, the central banks and the governments. And you have to wonder what they're worried about, why they are bulking up on this and why individuals are following along, aside from just the momentum trade that's happening right now. A short break, and then we're going to get to our guest today. I want to talk about Interactive Brokers because they have key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors like you. IBKR's margin loan rates are just from 4.37% to 5.37%. In fact, IBKR was rated one of the lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. Compare IBKR's clients' low margin borrowing costs to other brokers like Schwab and E-Trade, Fidelity, and Vanguard, who charge hundreds of basis points above IBKR's low rates. The best informed investors, they choose Interactive Brokers. Please note that margin is only for experienced investors with high risk tolerance. You may lose more than your initial investment. Rates are also subject to change. Get started today at ibkr.com/compare. Member SIPC. And our guest today is Ed Easterling. He's the founder and president of Crestmont Holdings, an Oregon-based investment management and research firm that publishes provocative research on financial markets at crestmontresearch.com. He has over 30 years of alternative investment experience, including financial markets, private equity, and business operations. He's also the author of recently released Probable Outcomes, Secular Stock Market Insights, and Unexpected Returns. In addition, he is a contributing author to Just One Thing and co-author of chapters in Bull's Eyes Investing by John Malden. Pretty good. We've had him on before. He's great. Let's get right to it. Hey, Ed, how are you?
Doing great, Andrew. Great to be with you again.
So, been a little while since we were together last, and markets have become continued to be extraordinary, just incredibly resilient in the face of a lot. Let's just say that. I just did an opening monologue on the podcast before you got on, talking about how there's an interesting blend of transparency and obfuscation at the same time, and how, you know, we see things, hear things, read things, but yet are we quite sure with what's going on and whether or not that is purposeful or it is, you know, in a plan to control things, or if it's just a haphazardly chaotic methodology. I don't know. I'm not going to really ask you about that, but that's kind of where we are right now. What I want to start with today, and we can get back into that, is I want to talk about Crestmont and what you do. I want our listeners, you've been on a few times, a day in the life of what you do, kind of, you know, not every single thing, but research, news, charts, writing. Give me a glimpse into the day in the life of Ed Easterling at Crestmont, what you do.
Sure. So keep in mind, Crestmont's approach to financial market research, analysis, and presentation is that of a climatologist, a market climatologist, and not a weather forecaster. So I'm not trying to discern the daily trends, et cetera. So it is always stepping back with that big picture view, trying to understand what the next 5 or 10 years offers. So we're trying to provide that landscape view for investors to understand the environment that we're in general. And then they've got to work to navigate the ups and downs. Now, for long-term investors, the short-term ups and downs aren't as big a deal. For short-term traders, knowing the long-term trend can be a big deal just because it's helpful to know the momentum.
Right. Got it. So you're looking at a variety of different charts, technical indicators, market movement, sentiment. But I guess what you're trying to tell me is that it's not whether it's going to rain in 5 minutes that concerns you. It's global warming, which may be a bigger issue or not in the vernacular of investing.
In the vernacular of investing, exactly.
Right.
And, you know, just for example, just this past week, looking into you mentioned the market's just roaring ahead. They're talking about new highs. Highs in the market price aren't as relevant as what we're reaching now are highs or near highs in market valuation relative to earnings. So Looking back to, you know, Bob Shiller's data going back to 1871, 154 years, we are now at the highest level for the cyclically adjusted PE that we've, other than 2 years, other than 1999 and 2000. In that 154 years, this is the highest level of relative valuation for the market. That's significant. That's significant for investors over the next 5 years and 10 years and 20.
Well, I mean, one of the things you hear about that when the CAPE ratio is those levels that it can't necessarily stay at those levels for a prolonged period of time, and you get a reversionary type of trade, which is going to bring things down. And that is not 1 year, 2 year, but, you know, you look at a 10 year period where it was and look at the next 10 year period. And, you know, how can it be that we're going to see another, well, let's just take it in a 5 year period. How could it be that, you know, you're going to see a 25% compounded annual growth rate of the tech stocks, the NASDAQ and, or the S&P 500 at, you know, 16%. With PE ratios at these levels, and how long is it going to be that people will stand for that kind of outward look? If in fact, we have to qualify this. If in fact earnings aren't going to keep up that extraordinary momentum that they had before.
Exactly. And then when we dig deep, and that's, so you know, you said in the life of the analysis at Crestmont Research. So key drivers of earnings, will earnings continue up? Well, let's look at where earnings margins are in relation to where they've been historically. And we're at very high levels of profit margin. So again, that would suggest that there's some vulnerability to margin decline, potentially. What's it run in relation to? How about the economy? Is the economy set to surge ahead over the next 5 or 10 years and catch up with market valuation? But again, you start looking at some of the macro factors affecting the economy, some of the predictions of the economy, even in the short run, with all the fiscal stimulus that's been put in place. I think it's that's what we're looking at. And again, there's no it's more propensities than it is necessarily expected outcomes.
You know, I find it really kind of fascinating that that this CAPE ratio has risen so dramatically. And this is a long-term calculation. It's not a short-term. Like, so I'm not saying that the PE ratio is, you know, 25 times where it was, right? What we're saying is that there is a situation out there that is telling us that something is wrong with the valuations in terms of history on a long-term basis, not just a short-term basis. How do we reconcile the two?
Absolutely, Andrew. So the way you reconcile that is what Shiller's doing is he's looking back at 10 years worth of earnings, because what Benjamin Graham noticed over 100 years ago is that earnings go through a cycle. And so it often takes periods of 7 years or longer, according to Graham. Shiller uses 10. So 10 years worth of earnings, inflation adjusted forward, so we're not understating it according to inflation, and then use that as a metric. What that does is it creates and the reason they call it the CAPE, the cyclically adjusted PE, is the cycle that it's adjusting for is the earnings cycle. So it's taking those ups and downs and smoothing them out. So that's much more relevant to market valuation, especially long-term valuation, than it would be to look at just any 1 year, whether if earnings spike or earnings dip, that can distort the value of PE on a short-term basis. Mm-hmm. But CAPE does that. Now, Crestmont also has a method.
Yeah, I know you have your own.
Right, the Crestmont PE. And that's built on looking at the long-term relationship historically between gross domestic product and earnings. And earnings tend to rise and fall in the long term in a tight correlation to GDP.
That would just make sense.
Well, because essentially GDP represents the sales of all companies in the economy, right? That's the gross domestic product. It's what everybody's making on net. Earnings, we use earnings in the S&P 500 is a surrogate for earnings for the economy, but essentially what we're looking at there is earnings in relation to sales.
Yeah.
So it normalizes for margins. And it's just a different method. The Crestmont PE and the CAPE have a very tight correlation, even though they're different methodologies, partially because they're both fundamentally based, fundamentals as in value versus earnings. It's just both are using different methods to adjust for the cyclicality of earnings.
And it's interesting because you have a raw number like a PE ratio that a lot of times these talking schmucks on TV talk about, you know, that, the PE of this is 17 on this bank, which is cheaper than the 25 on this tech company. I'm like, oh my God. You know, it's like, are we really doing this game of just talking about a one-dimensioned valuation tool that really shouldn't be used the way they're using it? But here's the question.
Yeah.
Is the CAPE at these levels number one at the highest level except for 2 points in history? And by the way, significantly above its 10-year average, because a lot of times the CAPE ratio is plotted along its 10-year average. And right. It's way above its 10-year average, which tells you the smoothing average of the smooth index is way out of whack. Is that something that's concerning? And if so, what do you do about it? If not, why?
Sure. And I would tend to look at this as the CAPE ratio would be a data point. If it were the only data point out there showing that we had this ultra high valuation, then we could call that an anomaly. Instead, it's really a confirmation. It's a confirmation of other measures of excess valuation. Whether it's the valuation in relation to price, in relation to assets,
mm-hmm.
Or assets rather, book value, whether it's, you know, the other different measures of valuation that analysts use, we're finding they're all in right now have very high values. So I think there's a recognition the market's high. In my mind, the question is whether it's high in anticipation of things happening, or is it high because it's gotten very frothy, because we have a very speculative tone in the markets right now, right? It's not just in equities.
And let me,
we're seeing it over in the debt markets with
private placement. I agree. Debt markets. I was just looking at some of the performance of our debt this year. I'm like, what? I mean, I knew the numbers, but I looked again and I'm like, wow, that's unbelievable. That is literally unbelievable. The fact that we've earned, you know, 8.5% on our debt, for example, for this client this year on the international side, it has been outstanding. But the bigger question is, I think when we look at this, is that if in fact we have powers, beings, institutions that don't care about valuations, for example, you have an announcement by X company that they're going to do a $6 billion, $7 billion, $10 billion, $2 billion buyback. And the reason for that is to buy back shares to help their earnings on an EPS basis, right? And on top of that, to hold up the stock because the options exercises that are going on by the insiders need to have stocks that are, you know, need to have buyers of them and being held up. And they don't really care about the timing nor the valuation. And because of the share shrinkage, because the share shrinkage and the number of companies, but there is a fascinating story, a story on the amount of actual companies that are in the market. The amount of actual stocks that you can buy has shrunk dramatically over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the share count has shrunk dramatically, not in totality because new companies come out, but on a company by company basis. I mean, they keep on shrinking it. And that being the case, they're goosing their EPS. There's another data point for you. Is that something that is in your radar?
Oh, let's see. It's certainly something to consider. I think the goal, though, is to recognize, or one of the aspects is to recognize that just because we're reducing the available stocks, that may reduce the supply available to investors. And therefore, it may bid up prices out of scarcity.
Yep.
But what that doesn't change is the fact that those investments, because of their price in relation to their earnings and their growth in earnings, are setting up for below average returns,
mm-hmm.
or well below average returns. So I guess if I'm an investor and I hear, gosh, market's high valuation, I'm looking for, does that necessarily mean that I'm going to have below average returns? Because historically, high values led to below average returns. Below average values led to above average returns. Because if you pay less for something, a stream of earnings, you get a better return than if you pay a whole lot more for it.
I just don't know necessarily if with all the confusion, chaos, central bank tinkering, buybacks, sovereign wealth funds, I just don't know if price discovery is even a thing right now. I don't mean to sound all dour about it.
No. I think what you're describing when you say price discovery, what I hear there is the market functioning normally to recognize that that it's buying something in relation to a future return.
Right. That's what I mean.
Instead, it's really buying it more in relation to momentum or scarcity. I mean, we've seen, but that then misaligns a fundamental relationship, the relationship of the return for investors coming out of a company, the fundamental return of the earnings in relation to the price they're paying.
Right.
It's distorted by the fact that their current price of their investment is going up, despite the fact that it's getting well beyond the reach of those earnings.
Right.
But interestingly, we're seeing the same thing happening in the housing market today.
Well,
Look at house prices in relation to
I was just talking about that before. House prices are ridiculous. It's not, you know, this whole notion, or it's misguided notion, that housing, that people are not able to buy houses because interest rates are too high. No, hello. They can't buy houses because prices are absurd.
And it drives down into payment, right? Because at the end of the day, people don't buy homes on price, they buy it on payment. And what happened 4 or 5 years ago, when mortgage rates went down to 3%, the value of the house that they could afford to pay to still keep a low payment was very high, and it boosted prices up significantly.
Right.
Okay. And by the way, we talked about the fact how prices are going up because mortgage rates had gone in half from over 6% to less than 3%.
And that's a natural reaction. That's like that's physics of finance.
But what changed though was suddenly in the last few years, mortgage rates have gone from that below 3 to now 6.5. We should have found that physics would have tempered, if not caused those prices to return back to levels that were normalized with that level of payment.
Yes.
But it hasn't happened. Matter of fact, I think I saw a report out that one of the first reports came out that housing prices may have declined by 1.5 or 2% last year.
Right.
Now, that doesn't realign to payments at all. In fact, most of the charts are showing right now housing price to income. But what housing price to income doesn't show is the housing price to payment or the payment to income, you might say.
Yeah, or the affordability of housing. And I have a chart. The National Association of Realtors put this out. And we did some calculation on that as well. But you could look at what the housing affordability index is, and when it's better, when it's above or below this particular line, it's either better to buy or rent. And it's still better to rent.
Right.
And that's been like that for a few years now. Because of the income stream, that takes into consideration all the things you're talking about here.
Right. So I think the key message here that we're hitting on, we started talking about market valuation, stock market valuation. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking about the residential real estate market valuation.
Right.
And we look at the debt markets and look at the misalignments that are occurring there. So I think sort of the message is we've got this basket of misalignments that are all fundamental valuation based. And therefore it feels frothy. It feels like there is an optimism that's actually different than it was in 99. Let me just mention, because in 99, there was an expectation that the technology surge at the time would cause GDP to upsurge to 4%. Greenspan wrote about that at the time. So his contemporaneous view at the time was that would cause economic growth, therefore earnings growth, et cetera, for a decade or longer, according to Greenspan, go up to 4% real growth. So that was justification for it. I'm not seeing the same thing here today. Even AI, the Fed's saying it might add maybe a point a year over the next decade. Not even that, maybe half a point over the next decade.
I mean, there's some definite productivity issues. I mean, I feel it. And I'm just a small little, nothing when it comes to what the real use factor and real use case is for AI. Even if right now is the top tier, is the ultimate of what AI is ever going to get to, right here, I find a lot of really good use for it. And in fact, just the other day, I was doing an Excel spreadsheet and there was some complexity to it that I needed to do a comparison between a few different columns that were dependent on the other column. You follow what I'm saying? And I'm like, I can do these VLOOKUPs. Yeah. I can do this. I don't want to do this. Let me hand it off to someone in the office. I said, hey, I got an idea. Let me just prompt Copilot in Excel. And by golly, it took me about 3 different prompts because I had to get right what I was saying. And it gave me the full thing and created the spreadsheet with the information I needed. That's pretty cool.
Yes.
So, but let's also agree, or maybe not, you can disagree if you want, but I'm thinking you can agree, is that, go back to Greenspan, you have irrational exuberance and you have the old phrase that markets can stay, irrational longer than you can stay solvent if you're going against it. But there is there's a lot of ways this can come out. And part of it is, markets can stay at this level and earnings can grow into it. Economies can continue to push forward and there could be various factors like lower taxes, for example, is one of the reasons why margins are so good over the last 5 years or so. We know that, the lower tax rate on companies. But it can stay here for a while and doesn't necessarily have to end in like a lot of these doomsayers in a crash. It could just be, or massive correction. It could just be a slowdown for a little while, a little bit of a layoff for a period of time. It doesn't, and maybe not 20% growth a year like someone who just entered the market thinks it has been over the last 3 years, but maybe 5%, 6%.
And certainly over the very short run, over, you know, a handful of years or so. What happens ultimately, though, is if those margins are excessively wide, therefore the return on capital is excessively high, it will bring new entrants into the market.
Right.
Or the existing entrants will use that as an opportunity to build market share. It's the age-old business cycle that's gone back since business. And those competitive forces will normalize those margins over time. In the short run, they can certainly be windfall profit. But in the long run, financial economics will drive those things back in line. And that, again, is what, but again, this is not a new phenomenon. We look back over the last 100, 150 years in the stock market and in the economy, we've seen the same thing happen over and over and over.
Yep. But let's switch over because you mentioned GDP and you mentioned your particular gauge and you know, the way of using GDP and the Cleveland Fed's inflation now casting forecast in yes. December is looking at CPI to increase by, you know, 3%, right? Right. And we don't exactly know because we don't have the data because the government was closed. We're not exactly sure. PCE came in, they say, at the lower than expected. But it was, I mean, look, 3% is 3%, okay? Higher than the 2%. By the way, just for those that want to keep score at home, 50% higher than where they want it to be.
Right.
And they feel they could bring it down quickly, which they have not been able to. And mark my words, lowering interest rates is not going to help that cause. But is inflation stabilizing, in your opinion, or even beginning to decline? Or where are we going here?
Well, I think two messages there. The first is the Cleveland Fed does estimate 3% for November's report, which comes out in December next week. They did not have the Fed, the Bureau of Labor Statistics did not produce a bottoms up number for October.
Right.
They did do an extrapolated number because they needed a number to be able to use for TIPS securities, et cetera. And the number they extrapolated was 3%.
Or extrapolated equals guessed. Go ahead. Continue.
Exactly. No, just a mathematical. Exactly. So this number we're going to come out with is going to capture 2 months worth of underlying market information. Now, all that being said, I would anticipate that we're seeing a moderation of inflation beginning to occur. But because last November a year ago's inflation report for the 1 month of November was negative just for that month. And that month is falling out of the averages. So right. If we come in with even a zero level of inflation for the month of November, we will still see an increase in the reported inflation.
On the year over year. Yeah.
And I got to tell you, so I'm going to take the over on the Cleveland Fed's estimate because of that. Now, Cleveland Fed has been remarkably, their now casting number has been remarkably accurate month to month. So I would give a lot of weight to that. At the same time, we have some underlying seasonal factors that would suggest that we could see a number well, when I say well over, 3.2, 3.3 between now and December's report. So November's report will probably be up a little bit. December's report will probably be up a little bit. But then the fun happens because the first quarter of 25 mm-hmm. had some really, really high monthly inflation reports. So as those roll off into the early 26, expect that CPI is mm-hmm. headed back down. Probably we may recover half the ground between 3 and 2. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw 2.5 on inflation before summer.
But that's because of a
technical
mathematical
right.
calculation base. The fact of the matter is it's still 2.5%. It still means that if you look at a chart of prices, they will be the highest ever at that point.
Right. So why is all this important? Number one, it probably explains why the Fed found the liberty to do one more cut this past week,
mm-hmm.
right? Going down a quarter
yep.
because they said, you know what? We may get a little heat here in the next month or two because inflation's ticking up. But you know what? They're going to look back and see that we were wise and foresaw the decline in inflation. The second is they're also seeing a potential softness in the job market. You know, Powell's, that was, to me, the big report yesterday. The whole headline is about this quarter of a point.
I agree.
This past week. But I think the real story under that, he thinks that they may be overstating jobs, 60,000 jobs a month. And that number doesn't come out. You mentioned, obscurity and transparency. They're not going to revise the numbers until February. So we're going to finally find out in February whether we've been overstating jobs by hundreds of thousands cumulatively.
I mean, we saw that one report that showed, I think it was ADP, that showed, 120,000 jobs lost in the small businesses in the last month?
Right.
That was substantial. And it's funny because you don't see it in the economy. You don't see it in the stock market. You don't see it in most metrics. I mean, look around. It's not there. But it's pockets of little things here and there that are adding up to a bigger picture. You see some layoffs from companies, and AI is the excuse they're using. But the economy itself, you know, it's very hard to put together the idea that something is a problem when you have a Fed that's even talking about 2.9 to 3% GDP number, right. Unemployment at 4.4% round number, and it's nothing's falling off a cliff. Maybe it's a slow motion, but it doesn't look horrible as of yet.
And that, so the chances of the right now the poly betting markets view of recession in 26 is now dropped below 30%. So, and that's probably even only that high because of the exogenous risk that there's all this, that government shutdown took away a lot of good data. Mm-hmm. In a sense, Fed is going to be doing some revisions to this payroll number that won't jobs number, but that won't happen until February. This inflation numbers, the reports that come out each month, the 12-month report that comes out every month is showing some statistical anomalies that will look a much different picture in 4 months than it does today. Matter of fact, you mentioned that only takes us 2.5. And that's part of the reason that the St. Louis Fed publishes two numbers that we watch closely. One is the 3-year expected inflation rate. And they're saying that that number right now is 2.4%. So even if we get down to 2.5, it sort of says we're going to stay up in the mid twos for the next 3 years on average. Even more discouraging, though, is the five-year forward, which is the average for the 5 years that starts in 5 years. Right. So that's the back half of the next 10 years. And even that's only 2.2. They're still not getting us back to the 2% target.
Yeah. So, even though they say they will, because they have to maintain that status of that we'll get there.
Right. And the big tie back end of all of this to the first part of our conversation is that the PE ratio has typically had a strong relationship to the inflation rate. As inflation goes higher, that causes bond yields to go higher. That causes PE ratios to go lower. So higher inflation is bad for valuation. Lower stable inflation is good for, that's when we get our best PEs.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we're staying elevated, I mean, it's not like the market's anticipating we're headed back to 1.5, which is where we were just, 5 years ago, 7 years ago.
But again, you still with that, it's a good environment. Everything's good right now. You know, if the economy's not good, the lowering interest rates, that's good for the stock market. If GDP comes at a good number, that's good for the stock market. If unemployment comes in at 4.5%, that's good. If it comes in at 3.9, that's good. Everybody is looking at everything being good. And the fact is, there's a couple of small pockets of issues that are going on, but everybody's trying to see the future. One of the reasons has been, at least I'm thinking, that there's again, back to this whole controlled chaos and this artificiality of this transparency, which is really saying projections that are not actually happening, but nobody checking on it. For example, we know things like, we hear these great pieces of information of things that are going to be happening, but we never, the NVIDIA chips being sold to China, but then China's like, no, we're not doing that. We're not buying that. we hear things like Sam Altman, Oracle. These players have been boosting and touting. They know there's no ramifications of this. It used to be that, look, I'm not going to, how am I going to give you a 2-year outlook? Most companies can't give an outlook past a quarter. That's the only visibility they have. Maybe 6 months, maybe if they are established. Meanwhile, Sam Altman is saying he's going to spend $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years doing XYZ. It's like, wait, dude, you haven't even made any profit yet. How are you going to get all this money? But Nobody was looking at that. And I think that's continues to be what the investors are. There's a gigantic, here's the point. There's a gigantic carrot that just will not go away. Because I think investors are resigned to the fact, and this is good, actually, that we're not looking, just this is actually not bad. We're not looking at today or tomorrow. We're looking 5 years from now, 10 years from now. Does it really matter if there's a little bit of a correction and overvaluation and a little bit of bubbly right now? I get in now. If it's going to be higher later, what's the difference? I'll get a couple extra points. Maybe that's nice, but it doesn't really matter. Yeah.
Well, we could replay that scenario by thinking about asking ourselves the same thing in the late 90s.
But it took 10 years to get it all back, but you got it back in a lot more.
Not all of it.
I'm talking about index-wise.
With the subsequent 10 or 15 years providing a mid-single digits return.
I get it.
So you're right. Let's see. I guess, and people will often say, the nice thing about stocks, if you stay invested long enough, you'll make money. But you may not make as much money as you can make in alternative investments like bonds or otherwise, real estate, a variety of investments that people use. The second is that timing is important too, because for a lot of investors, those going into retirement or those that are in retirement, having that 15-year dearth before you recover while you're taking capital out can have a significant impact on their ultimate success, investment success.
You brought up just now alternative investments. There's a lot of different definitions of that, but private equity, private credit, clearly we define as alternatives, right?
Yeah, and when I threw out alternatives, I realized at that moment that I didn't want to imply the capital A alternatives. I was really thinking about alternatives like bonds,
alternatives real estate, to stocks, alternatives to
alternatives to stocks, exactly. But you're right. There's a broad marketplace out there of alternative investments that are packaged and available to a broad base of investors.
What is your thinking or research or at least your insight into what's going on right now with some of the private credit? Private equity put aside, there's some issues there that I'm hearing bubbling up to, buying things at valuations that are dumb, and some people trying to cash out and not getting out. You know, some of the players trying to do the round trip, what private equity usually does. But private credit, it seems to me that there is an insatiable appetite for debt, which I don't know where it exactly comes from, but it's from a lot of places. Private credit has had its little issues lately with Yield Street, with Blue Owl, few others out there, and we're starting to see little, I don't know if it's canaries in the coal mine or if it's just aberrations of bad firms doing poor deals. Any insights into that at all?
Yeah, let's see, just only insight from a macro standpoint. All the signs are there that there's a lot of vulnerability in that market. It's not often that until the tide goes out that you see whose boat's floating. And I think what we've not seen is a correction in that marketplace for quite a while. So again, I don't have direct insight into specific subsectors or issues other than to say that when we look at the macro factors, that's another area that's showing frothy valuations or low margins that aren't necessarily protective of the risk.
So if we back off of this and look back at this conversation, and if you reflect and you had to tell me, I know you're not short-term minded, but I get that. But if you had to tell me your best guess as to the next, let's give it 1, 3, 5 years in the future, based on all this, right? About your various, the macro environment, the valuations, the various indicators, things you know, things you see. I mean, is there anything that is flashing a red light that's like, there's a problem or that you've seen before that you'll act on? Or is this more of your run-of-the-mill frothiness? And how does the outlook look over the next few years?
Sure. So as the climatologist, I will answer your question about 1, 3, and 5.
And so let's go to the back.
For the one-year view, let me just flip it. Okay, it said heads. I'm going to go with the markets down. Let's see, 3 years. Flipped it again. Okay, that says it's up. Now, 5 year. When we start getting to 5 years or 10 years, I predict that that investors will have well below average returns, that there will be a single digit, mid-single digits or below on a cumulative basis over that period. That this level of valuation And I think it's a much more likely case over the next 10 than the next five. Just because the momentum is so strong, we could end up seeing a few years here of continuing. I'm not sure right now if we're at 96 or we're at 99.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
You know, the year 96 and 99.
No, I get that.
But at the same time, I think we're definitely, quote unquote, in the late 90s again. And that if we look out over, no matter where you were in the late 90s, if you looked then to the late 2000s, that cumulative return was consistently mid-single digits or below. And for some sectors, if you were in the more aggressive, and that's the one challenge. And I know you probably talk a lot to market analysts about this, that we have an S&P 500 that's really a small group of high tech, high valuation stocks and a broad market that's kind of a separate set of that. And those are kind of combined together. This is kind of an unusual level of the lack of diversification in that index, right?
Yeah, 38% of the index, I think, is the top 10.
Right.
That is anybody who's anybody will tell you that is not diversified. And that is the potential. But at the same time, because of the way the mechanics of the market, right, and because of all those companies are the big buyback kings, and because those are the players that everybody wants to be with a big cash cow, et cetera, you know, right now, would it take a lot to topple them? Yes and no. But, you know, because there's so much money flowing into the passive investments right now, the bigger are just getting bigger, much bigger.
And right.
It helps the index.
So this is an environment. So again, I think the forecast, we're going to say, yes, valuations have gotten high. There was, you know, we definitely needed a correction. A correction has helped to put us back on better, on more solid footing. And we'll probably look at some small but significant economic challenges over the next decade.
Good stuff. Ed, tell us where people can get information on Crestmont Holdings.
Crestmont Research. So it's crestmontresearch.com. If you online, it's Crestmont, C-R-E-S-T-M-O-N-T, research.com. It's an open access website with articles, charts, graphs, and other information that are available to investors to use as a tool, as a resource to help in their investment needs. If that particularly perks your interest, there are a couple of books out there, Unexpected Returns and Probable Outcomes, that go into more detail about this. And I welcome reader comments on any and all of those materials.
Great stuff. Great stuff. Listen, you have a happy and healthy holiday, a great new year. Best to you and yours, your family, and all things that are wonderful should be coming your way.
And back to you, Andrew. All the best, and I'll see you in the new year.
All right, thanks. See ya. You bet. That's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me this week. And we have some great things happening. We have Harry Dent coming up, Todd Trezeter in the next week or so, and next couple weeks, actually, coming up. So we're pretty excited about that. We're going to end the year with Jack Schwager. We have a great interview, I'm sure, going to happen with him, talking about the greatest of the great investors of this age. So don't miss that. Make sure to be there. Thanks for joining me, and I'll see you again real soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.